hppodcraft.com.
The circumstances I'm about to relate to you have truth to recommend them. They happened to myself, and my recollection of them is as vivid as if they had taken place only yesterday. 20 years, however, have gone by since that night. During those 20 years, I have told the story to but one other person. I tell it now with a reluctance which I find it difficult to overcome. All I entreat, meanwhile, is that you will abstain from forcing your own conclusions upon me. I want nothing explained away. I desire no arguments. My mind on this subject is quite made up, and having the testimony of my own senses to rely upon, I prefer to abide by it.
That is the first paragraph from The Phantom Coach by Amelia B. Edwards.
It sure is, and we're covering it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
Now, I want to issue a quick trigger warning for this episode. We're handling some sensitive topics this month. Obviously, the Screwfly solution last week provoked all sorts of emotional reactions for its relevance to modern social issues. And in this case, with the Phantom Coach, I just want to let listeners know that, you know, if you've ever played sports in school, maybe you were on the softball team and you had a coach that you played pranks on, and, you know, one of the pranks went awry, resulting in that coach's death. And then the coach came back from the grave to get revenge on you and all your sexy teenage friends. If that's a situation you've dealt with in your life, this story, The Phantom Coach, might set you off.
Wait, Chad, have you actually read this story?
I gave it a read. I read the title.
You should read the story.
That's just my opinion of what the story is about. You can have yours. I mean, we can disagree, but I think everybody should have a voice in what the story is about. Speaking of voices, who was that we heard at the top?
Why, that's Paul McLean, host of YoggSothoth.com, where they do awesome podcasting, they do live games, they have great forums, news on all things Lovecraftiana. It's a great website. You should check it out. And Paul's a stand-up kind of guy, so... Paul McLean at YoggSothoth.com.
Glad to hear from Paul again. It's been a while since we've had him on the show.
Yeah, I know. That's a crying shame.
He's a good dude. Well, this story, The Phantom Coach, I actually read a really great article about classic female horror authors a few years ago that talked about Elizabeth Gaskell, whom we're going to cover this month as well.
Right.
And this author, Amelia B. Edwards, both wrote traditional ghost stories, among other things, but the article discussed how they at times approached the weird, even though these were traditional ghost stories. And this, in particular, was singled out. I think this is her most anthologized story.
Yeah,
unfortunately, I couldn't find that article again, but I had already pulled the stories for us to cover. But I thought, hey, let's keep up with the female writers this month. Not that we won't cover female authors plenty of other times in the year, but honestly, I was grasping for a theme. This is what it became. I certainly wasn't going to do a theme of men killing women for the month or... You know, insects burrowing into wounds. Actually, Jason Thompson suggested an alien invasion theme, which was great, but suggested that a little too late. Maybe we'll talk about that in our bonus content this month.
There you go.
But for right now, we're doing weird women authors, and I'm glad that we are. And I don't believe that these were authors that Lovecraft discussed much, although I bet he probably read these stories. They were popular at the time.
Yeah.
What do we know about Amelia B. Edwards?
Well, she was a writer, and I feel like I should have known about her because she was extraordinary. And she was a novelist, a journalist, and Egyptologist.
Yeah, a classic triple threat.
The classic novelist, journalist, Egyptologist. Happens so much, it's almost a trope.
It is, at this point. But she was one of the originals.
Yeah, well, she was born in London in 1831. Her Irish mother educated her at home, where she took to writing. She published her first poem at the age of 9 and her first story at the age of 12.
Wow.
Not only a writer, she was a very talented artist as well. And her parents weren't really into her being an artist, so she kind of dropped it. And that's something that she regretted throughout her life. Even though I saw some of her drawings, she was amazing. The stuff in her travel books is way past professional. It's really good. I don't know why she should feel any kind of regret being able to do that. Maybe she wanted to be like a Rembrandt or a Monet or something, and that's what she regretted, that if she pursued it in that level. But man, I thought the stuff I saw of hers was amazing.
Oh yeah, her illustrations from the trip along the Nile were totally blowing my mind. They were so fantastic. She was really talented. She was even a musician and a singer. but she actually had had a bout of typhus that hurt her throat, and so she had to give the singing up. Oh. But she really was, I mean, she was good at everything.
So her first novel was in 1855, it was called My Brother's Wife, but her real breakout novel was Barbara's History, and that came out in 1864. That was the same year that she wrote this story, The Phantom Coach, but she also wrote other ghost stories as well.
Her last novel, Lord Brackenbury, from 1880, was a real runaway hit. That was probably her biggest one. It went to 15 editions.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, she traveled around a lot, got really into the Dolomites, which I thought was a blaxploitation film, but it turns out they're mountains in Italy.
You know, although the movie Dolomite has some relation to this story because it features Dolomite's classic line, "Ghosts, if you ever see a ghost, cut the mother." It's as true today as it was in 1975.
What?
Yeah, that's a line from that movie. I think I've even mentioned it on the show before.
I believe you. I wish I had the context of it, but you know what? Let's let that lie. I can dream. Edwards went on to Egypt in 1873 and wrote and illustrated a travel log called 1,000 Miles Up the Nile in 1877. She was so into Egypt and its history that she gave up regular writing to become a full-time Egyptologist. She died in 1892 at the age of 60.
You can still see relics and illustrations from her time in Egypt in museums around the world. I know there's a couple collections in London. Quite an amazing human being. So let's talk about her story, The Phantom Coach.
This story starts like many of these stories do, a narrator telling us what happened many years ago.
It's a classic ghost story slash weird fiction opening, and I like the bluntness of it. I want nothing explained away. I desire no arguments. Basically an 1800s version of "Don't at me, bro. I'm going to tell you this. I don't want to hear what you think about it. Just let me get the story out."
The narrator's name is James Murray, and he's a lawyer. In his tale, he's hunting grouse alone in the moors of northern England, and he gets lost.
And this was something that happened 20 years before the telling, as we heard in the opening. That 20 years ago, it was December. He's been out all day long.
The weather is turning very cold, and he has no idea where he's gotten to. Now, James is a newlywed, and his wife is expecting him home. She will freak out if he doesn't get back to the house.
It says, "I thought how my young wife was already watching for me through the window of our little inn parlor, and I thought of all the suffering in store for her throughout this weary night." It is truly the worst when you're waiting for a loved one and they are just not showing up. Especially here, they're on holiday of some sort, not familiar with this area, the far north of England. And she had implored him earlier in the day to return before dusk. He promised he would. Good job, dum-dum. Why would you make that promise and then walk as far as you have?
So it gets dark and it begins to snow and he's scared. If he stops to rest, he could fall asleep. And if he falls asleep, he could freeze to death. So he has to keep on keeping on. Now, I've been up in the moors driving on a single road for miles and I've seen nothing but moorland. So I can easily imagine getting lost up there. Like if you think you're going back the way you came and you're just going further into the moors, that's a disturbing prospect. He's calling out every so often with the hopes of somebody hearing him, but he never gets any kind of response.
Then a wavering speck of light came suddenly out of the dark, shifting, disappearing, growing momentarily nearer and brighter.
It's a lantern, and it's in the distance, and he runs to it. Quickly, he's face-to-face with this old guy who seems confused to see James out on the moors. James explains that he's lost and wants to know where he is.
Yeah, that inn that he's staying at, it's in the village Dwolding, and the old man says, well, that's 20 miles away. He asks, well, where's the nearest village? And even that one, it's Wyke, I think that's right, which is 12 miles away. And the old man seems kind of annoyed to have to deal with him, despite the fact that he's scared and alone out here.
James just tells the old man that he's going to go with him. He doesn't give him any options. He's like, look, I'm going to go with you. And the old guy isn't sure what to do about it because, of course, if the guy's going to follow him, he's going to follow him. He can't, like, fight him or nothing. So he tells him that his master won't let him stay at the house. And James says, well, let me ask your master. And the guy can see that, you know, he's just not going to shake him. So he's like, all right, come with me. So he takes James to this big farmhouse.
As they approach, it says a large mass loomed up presently out of the darkness and a huge dog rushed out, barking furiously. So it's the old animal jump scare, you know, gotta get it in there early. The old man tells the dog to get down and moves to the door, which is, it says, heavily studded with iron nails, like the door of a prison.
So the old guy tries to not let James in, but he just pushes past and gets into the house.
Yeah, I'm so used when we do stories like this, I'm so used to English politeness. I was amazed at how forward James is about this, but I suppose, you know, his survival's at stake, so he's going to be pushy if he needs to.
So inside the house, there are lots of books and a telescope. Bell rings and the old man says, "That's for you. Go see the master." James goes into the study where an old man is looking at some books and some papers, and he seems pretty angry. And he asks, "Who are you? How came you here? What do you want?" And James says, "James Murray, barrister at law, on foot across the moor. Meet, drink, and sleep."
Isn't he even going to offer to pay for it or anything? You know, it's so pushy.
Yeah.
And this old man is described as huge. So even though he's an old man, he's not frail. He's got bushy brows and a portentous frown. And he says, "Mine is not a house of entertainment. Jacob, how dared you admit this stranger?" To the old man that he met on the moor. So now we know the old servant's, you know, the old servant's name is Jacob.
So Jacob says, "I didn't let him in. He just came in because I'm a little old man and I can't, this guy's like 22 or something, so yeah. I can't deal with it. And he's got a gun." But James explains that he would die if he stayed out there and he just wants to live. "Let me stay the night and I will be on my way in the morning." And the master kind of looks him over and he says, "All right, Jacob, make him a meal. He could stay the night."
With this, he waved me to a seat, resumed his own, and became at once absorbed in the studies from which I had disturbed him. So there's this sense of oddness about the whole thing, because they're in the middle of nowhere. You might not be surprised to find a farmhouse out here.
Sure.
But this guy doesn't seem to be a farmer. He's clearly an academic of some type.
So looking around the place, there is all of what seems to be some kind of research going on. There's a model of a solar system writing on the walls in the form of equations and lots of books and papers.
There's even a small organ, fantastically decorated with painted carvings of medieval saints and devils, and a small galvanic battery.
So at dinner, they don't talk. And James, however, loves the food, even though the master says that it's meager. Perhaps not eating all day can make, you know, food taste a little bit better than it normally does.
Well, yeah. And he says it's some ham and eggs and brown bread, which sounds pretty good to me. Although his host just eats some milk and porridge. That's all he has for himself. I guess somebody's got to represent the Wuthering Heights diet since we're up here on the moors. Has to be a sad little meal.
After they eat, the master says that he's been in retirement for 23 years and that he hasn't seen a stranger in over 4 years.
He also hasn't read a single newspaper in all of that time. 23 years he has stayed away from the modern world.
So he asked James if he could fill him in on the news of the world, and James is more than happy to do so because this guy's really helping him out. But the master's questions are focused around science, and James doesn't really know much about science in general. But this gets them into talking, and then the master, he begins to sort of go off on subjects of philosophy, and then he goes into magic and music and ghosts.
Yeah, he talks about how he used to play softball in school and how there was this particularly nerdy coach that he and the other kids used to pick on. And they dumped some freezing water on the guy while he was in the locker room shower, and he had a heart attack, which they didn't expect. Nobody expected that to happen.
He does not say any of that, but he does talk about how the world is more and more skeptical and that there are many things out in the world that mankind doesn't understand.
Yeah, he's disgusted that people reject anything that resists experiment and maintains that ghosts have been supported by testimony from every area of the world throughout time. It says, attested by all races of men in all ages and in all climates, by the soberest sages of antiquity, by the rudest savage of today, by the Christian, the pagan, the pantheist, the materialist. They've all said they've seen apparitions, so how can we dismiss this so readily?
He explains that he set out to scientifically prove the existence of ghosts and the supernatural, but he was laughed out of the scientific community, and that is why he retired here.
"They laughed at me at university, but I'll show them." I love the disgruntled mad scientist archetype.
Yeah.
One of my favorites.
James seems sympathetic towards him. The master looks out the window and he sees that the snow has stopped. James says that he wishes it wasn't 20 miles to the inn. He would go now if he could make it, since his wife is back there waiting for him. And the master thinks on this and he says, "Well, there might be a way for you to get back tonight. The night mail coach goes past fairly soon and it goes to Dwolding." He says that he could get Jacob, the old man, to take him out there. James is like, "Well, yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah, let's do it." And so the master said, "Great. You know, have some whiskey before you go because it's going to be cold out there and this will warm you up." So he takes a shot of some whiskey and it's really strong. And then he's off with Jacob. It's very cold outside and not a star in the sky. And it's very, very quiet. Jacob points to a stone fence and tells him to follow that 3 miles up to the crossroads.
Yeah, that's where he's going to meet this mail coach.
Jacob also tells him that he should be careful as part of the wall is broken off over a cliff, a bit of a drop off. And that's where the accident happened. And he's like, "What accident?" And he goes, "Oh, well," Jacob explains that the night mail coach went over the wall and everybody that was inside died in or just after the accident. And that happened 9 years ago.
The road was too steep and narrow, and so the carriage couldn't navigate it, went right over, plunging to destruction. strong Large Marge vibes are coming across here suddenly. 10 years ago, I saw the worst accident I ever seen. And it's an important thing to note. There were people in the carriage. He says four were found dead and the other two died next morning. So there were probably, there's a coachman and maybe his security or an alternate coachman and then four passengers in this carriage. Mm-hmm. One of the passengers could very well have been a softball coach getting rushed to the hospital after a heart attack. We don't know. There's nothing in the text about it. So we just kind of have to read between the lines. Yeah.
But this story was written in the mid-1800s, and there was no softball.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely was not a softball coach.
Sure. I mean, you know, interpretations. That's what's fun about this story. I mean, there's a lot you can read into it.
Yeah, sure. He watches Jacob walk away, and he can see the lantern getting smaller and smaller until it's finally gone. The weather gets colder and colder.
He's whistling against the dark a bit because it's so silent and solitary. He hums to himself. He starts doing math in his head. To some extent, he succeeds in calming himself. But the tale of that destroyed carriage, it's still kind of bugging him.
As he walks along the road, he can see a light and a shape in the distance. As it gets closer, you can see it's the coach.
Right, the carriage that he came to meet up with. It's important. The coach has a double meaning, so let's just be careful. I'm explicit here.
Okay, so the coach just blows right past him, but then it stops. So he runs to meet it, and he thanks the driver, but the driver doesn't say anything.
Says the coachman pulled up. The guard, muffled to the eyes in capes and comforters, and apparently sound asleep in the rumble, neither answered my hail nor made the slightest effort to dismount. The outside passenger did not even turn his head. So they've stopped, but nobody's really paying any attention to him in a real way.
He gets into the coach where there are three other passengers, and James greets them, but they say nothing to him, and they barely move at all. The coach takes off, and he tries to make small talk with the people in the coach, but nothing. Strangely, the air in the coach seems colder than being outside. Again, he tries to make small talk. He says, "How intensely cold is it tonight?" I said, addressing my opposite neighbor. He lifted his head, looked at me, but made no reply. "The winter," I added, "seems to have begun in earnest."
"It's December, dum-dum."
He's just not, nothing. So it's very dark in the cabin. He can't really get a good look at these people.
He can only just make out, like, maybe one of them has a whistle around his neck. Just a glimmer of that. Maybe that's what it is. Again, there's nothing explicit, but...
it's definitely not a whistle. Annoyed that the people won't talk to him, he tries to take down the sash, but the strap just rips off, and he sees that it's rotten, and then he kind of takes a good look at the inside of the cab, and he sees mold is growing all over it, and it's just kind of really falling apart.
The leather fittings were crusted over with mold and literally rotting from the woodwork. The floor was almost breaking away beneath my feet. The whole machine, in short, was foul with damp.
He says to one of the other passengers, "This coach is in a deplorable condition. The regular mail, I suppose, is under repair?"
He moved his head slowly and looked me in the face without speaking a word. I shall never forget that look while I live. I turned cold at heart under it. I turned cold at heart even now when I recall it. His eyes glowed with a fiery, unnatural luster. His face was livid as the face of a corpse. His bloodless lips were drawn back as if in the agony of death, and showed the gleaming teeth between. The words that I was about to utter died upon my lips, and a strange horror, a dreadful horror, came upon me. My sight had by this time become used to the gloom of the coach, and I could see with tolerable distinctness. I turned to my opposite neighbor. He, too, was looking at me, with the same startling pallor in his face and the same stony glitter in his eyes. I passed my hand across my brow. I turned to the passenger on the seat beside my own and saw, oh heaven, how shall I describe what I saw? I saw that he was no living man, that none of them were living men, like myself. A pale phosphorescent light, the light of putrefaction, played upon their awful faces, upon their hair dank with the dews of the grave, upon their clothes earth-stained and dropping to pieces, upon their hands, which were as the hands of corpses long buried. Only their eyes, their terrible eyes, were living, and those eyes were all turned menacingly upon me.
Yeah, I never saw any of this coming at all.
Yeah, I'm a little annoyed that the story's called The Phantom Coach.
Yeah.
It tells you exactly what's going to happen. It's a Phantom Coach. Like, they should have called it, like, a Dark Road or A Night on the Moors or something, so you don't know what you're...
No, I hear you. I mean, I feel that that can be interpreted multiple ways, but I hear what you're saying.
James screams, and he tries to get the door open, but he can't, and the coach goes over the cliff where that hole in the wall was with the crash. He is knocked out.
It's, of course, the classic fainting moment at the climax. The narrator goes unconscious, so can't tell us the rest of the story, really has to recount what happened after waking up later. We really should have come up with a specific literary term for this moment by this point. It's in so many stories we read. Yeah. You know what? Any suggestions are welcome. Let's codify this. Somebody come up with what this fainting moment is called.
That's great. Well, in this guy's case, it's not fainting. His head is freaking smashed.
Yeah, sometimes it's fainting. Sometimes it's a bolt of lightning. Sometimes they get hit on the head. But the point is they just fall unconscious.
Right.
Because the storyteller knows, okay, at this point I've hit the moment of horrific fright that I needed to.
Right.
Time to just wrap things up. So who cares, if he dramatizes what happens next?
So he wakes up in his home with his wife taking care of him. He seems to have been found by some shepherds on the spot where he went over the cliff. They got him to the doctor to tend to his broken arm and damaged head. Mm. Freaking rocked his head.
Yeah.
They found letters in his pocket with his address on it and were able to return him to the inn that he was staying at. Eventually, he recovered.
I never told my wife the fearful event which I have just related to you. I told the surgeon who attended me, but he treated the whole adventure as a mere dream born of the fever in my brain. We discussed the question over and over again, until we found that we could discuss it with temper no longer, and then dropped it. Others may form what conclusions they please. I know that 20 years ago, I was the fourth inside passenger in that Phantom Coach.
And that's the end of the story.
That is the end of the story.
So do you think the old scientist actually sent him out to the ghost carriage on purpose?
I was thinking that myself, because it seemed very specific.
I mean, otherwise, why happen across somebody who happens to be studying ghosts? Unless it's just to kind of discuss the issue of ghosts a bit before this happens.
It does seem like it was intentional on his part, and that maybe the guy was angry because he imposed himself on him and thought, well, I'm going to show you. And sent him off to the ghost carriage. But that seems awful extreme.
That's really extreme, I know.
So maybe it was just kind of a narrative tool to be able to talk about ghosts and set a mood. And there really was a male coach that was going to go by. Huh. The ghost coach went instead. I don't know.
Well, the other thing about it, and this is the only element of this that I think is weird. He was the fourth passenger. So when this wreck was recounted to him, it says there were four passengers that died.
Yeah.
So was his spirit in that 20, you know what I'm saying, 10 or 9 years before, when this crash happened, was there actually a fourth passenger in there, or was he the fourth passenger? That's what I was thinking. Was it like the other three passengers turned around and there was a freaking future spirit in the coach with them, and they went, oh my gosh, there's a ghost back here, and the guy goes, huh, and then they went over the bridge. I mean, did he inadvertently cause this crash?
No, I don't think that would be the case, because they would have found the body, because they said specifically that four people died and then the two people died later.
Right. But then in that case, then why, when he jumped into the coach, wasn't he the fifth passenger?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe one of the ghosts was okay with dying, so they moved on to the next world and their spirit wasn't holding on because they died unjustly.
Right. Oh, that's
interesting. But the other five were really bummed out about it, and so that's why they're still ghosts. I don't know. It's an odd story. It's well written, and it was an easy read, and I like her prose style.
Yeah, definitely.
But it is a bit predictive. I mean, it's called The Phantom Coach, and so you're just waiting for it to come up. It doesn't really offer any surprises or any twists. Obviously, the story's like 150 years old, so...
Yeah.
A lot of other stories probably borrow from this story.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we bag on ghost stories a lot, but I had a good time reading it. Look, there were some things that could have benefited. I thought maybe a teenager's head found in a basketball hoop. Maybe some kind of redemptive arc where there's like one fat kid who couldn't climb the gym class rope in the beginning, but manages to do it at the end when he's pursued by the Phantom Coach. Or maybe, somebody definitely gets like snapped to death by a bunch of floating towels. That would have been an interesting scene.
All right. Yeah. Or a podcast host who beats a joke to death.
It's such a lame joke. Thanks for hanging in with me there. I appreciate that. the element of him having some kind of time transfer or something is a little weird. But other than that, yeah. I don't know if I'd call this a weird tale. It's a pretty traditional ghost story.
Yeah, it seems to be a run-of-the-mill.
That's the only question, because otherwise it is the Large Marge story. You know, she pulls up and picks him up and tells him the story and then turns around and was the one who died in the wreck. You know, yeah. He goes in and
she
he
had
says,
a ghost truck.
I got picked up, and they're like, no, no, no.
Maybe Paul Reubens and Phil Hartman, who wrote Pee-wee's Big Adventure,
yeah,
maybe they read the story.
There are a lot of Phantom Coach stories out there. There's even touches of this right in the Robert Chambers we covered way, way back when we got off of Lovecraft. The yellow sign, there's that coach that goes through and he sees his own body in it when he looks
right,
down.
Yes,
you know,
it's a little different, though.
It's a little different, but I think this idea of of a wrecked vessel showing up again and picking people up might be really old. I mean, certainly there's ghost ship versions of this.
Oh, right, yeah.
Well, what do we got up next?
Next week, we are doing The Old Nurse's Story by Elizabeth Gaskell.
Yes, I've already read that one, and I liked it.
I liked it, but boy, she can take her time with things.
It goes on a little long, and we'll talk about it more next week, but she was sort of a buddy of Charles Dickens, and he had encouraged her to publish this story, The Old Nurse's Story, in a publication that he was running. And it's just, you know, Dickens is kind of the same way. I love him, and I really dig into all of his writing, but a lot of it he wrote, you know, per word, to get paid per word, and so it was serialized, and so it can go on and on and on. And yeah. Elizabeth Gaskell's kind of a student of that tradition, but I enjoyed it. You know what else I enjoy are our wonderful patrons.
I enjoy them deeply.
And I want to thank some of them now, and I'm going to start with Dean Muscat. Thank you so much.
I want to thank Timothy Kobus.
Zach Granny, you are incredible.
I'd like to thank Joe Favini.
Daniel Ray Glass, thank you so much.
I would also like to thank Francisco Guzman.
Rob Sheriff, you're the sheriff of my heart. I'm sure he'll find that hilarious. Oh, nobody's really used my name that way before.
I'd like to thank Steven Sprague.
I'd like to thank Lori Allred.
And of course, let's not forget Will Dennis. Thank you, Will.
You guys are all amazing. Thank you so much for continuing to allow us to do this show and hanging out with us while we read these awesome stories. We're going to be back again next week with another one, and that's all we have for now. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.